Welcome to In Conversation with Lyndon Terracini, the podcast where we meet the extraordinary talents, both on stage and off, working at Opera Australia. These conversations were all originally filmed for our streaming service, OA TV. You can find more online at tv.opera.org.au, as well as full productions and behind-the-scenes footage. And just a quick note, this conversation was recorded in mid-2020, when our Brisbane ring cycle was still scheduled for the end of the year. It's since been postponed until October and November 2021. You can find more information at opera.org.au/ring. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to OA TV. And my special guest today is Tahu Matheson. Tahu is the head of music at Opera Australia, and with that comes a lot of responsibility. He's responsible for not only looking after the music staff, but also ensuring that all the singers know their roles by the time the stage director arrives, and also the covers, who, in case of an emergency, they need to know all of those parts too, so they can jump in. So Tahu, welcome. And maybe we'll start at the very beginning.
Sure.
Tahu Matheson. Tahu's a New Zealand name, a Maori name, yeah?
Maori name, in fact, yeah. I wasn't actually born in New Zealand. I was born in London, but my father was how should we put it, partial to that side of things. Mm-hmm. There is Maori heritage on my father's side of the family. In fact, I think I'm actually a 16th Maori, which you can mm-hmm. see when you look at me immediately, I'm sure. But my dad always wanted to give us Maori names. I've got two brothers and they're Tane and Tama. Mm. We also had normal, as it were, Christian names. I've got John, my brothers had David and Charles, just in case. Mm-hmm. Because back then it wasn't popular to have these strange names.
Yeah.
Now it's terrific.
Yeah, yeah. Your father was a conductor. He was a repetiteur firstly at Covent Garden, and then I think he was the general music director in Mannheim, yeah?
Yeah, he was at Covent Garden for quite a while and then moved to Mannheim, and basically we followed him around the world. He actually auditioned my mother, who was an opera singer. Mm-hmm. So there was no real way of escaping the music side of things. Mm.
And so you were then, I guess, you were growing up in Mannheim in Germany and went to school in Germany, of course, learned to speak German.
Yeah, we moved to Mannheim when I was two, mm-hmm. and so German was almost my first language, which is very handy now, of course.
Yeah.
But after living there for several years, we moved to a small kind of what they call a Kurort, outside of Mannheim, about an hour away, called Lindenfels. And unbelievably, the Hauptstraße, the main street, is Die Nibelungenstraße.
Oh, really?
That's where it was all meant to have happened.
Yeah.
We could actually see the Odenwald, where the whole Siegfried myth was meant to have
That's
happened.
That's extraordinary.
So, yeah, German was basically my first language, and I went to just normal German school and spoke German at home and English. German at school, English at home, as you do when you're a child without even thinking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when did you commence piano studies?
Well, I started with my father. Mm. He was a fantastic dad, very sort of kind, loving, all those sorts of things. And then the piano teaching was a little different.
I guess it's like teaching your children to drive a car.
Yes, of course.
Not a good thing.
Never work with family. You know, you're always trying to teach them or tell them off. So
yeah.
Dad, you know, told us off quite a lot. I probably started when I was about four or five. Mm-hmm. And that really didn't take with Dad. And then we found some local teacher and then I started. Mm. To learn properly.
But you obviously had a natural connection to it.
Yeah, look, I mean, music was, of course, always in my life. So I remember in Mannheim, singers singing all the time. My mum sang around the house constantly. My dad sang around the house constantly, which was, you know, less pleasant. but that was in the air the whole time. And some of my earliest memories, when they're not of food, are of music. Mm. And I remember distinctly in Mannheim going to see a performance of Hänsel and Gretel, which Dad was conducting. And I couldn't remember the It's not the music I remember, it's the kind of the perfume of being in the theatre. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of a colour with it. And I don't know whether it was the colour that was on stage or a colour that I'm imagining now, but, you know, when Hansel and Gretel fell asleep and sang the incredible duet, I just remember this sort of bluish haze around things. And then when the witch went up at the end, burnt, and in this production, she went straight up into the heavens, it was completely red. Mm. And so I associate that very strongly. Then I went backstage and I met the witch, mm. who was confusingly a man. And it had such a strong effect on me. I was a little bit scared because he still had his costume. Mm. But it had, I mean, right from then, I knew I had wanted to be in this business somehow.
Mm. You're right, there is, theatres have a particular smell.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you go in backstage and you're in the dressing rooms, there's a particular smell that every theatre has, and it's an exciting thing, particularly if you want to work in the theatre. So I imagine that was an exciting experience for you as well, not just the show.
Yeah, just being in the theatre, and I mean, mm. everything's so alive. Mm. Everybody is on tenterhooks
yeah.
constantly. Even after the show, you know, when people are sort of, you know, reasonably tired, everybody's still up.
Yeah, it's got an energy about
oh,
it. Yeah,
it's constantly. Yeah. And it's thrilling.
It is,
thrilling
absolutely.
To be there. Thrilling to, yeah. to watch, thrilling to be a part of.
Yeah. So you started playing the piano in when you were a small child in, mm-hmm. in Germany. And then you came to Brisbane in Queensland.
Yeah. It was my dad. We basically followed him all around the world.
Yeah.
And he felt the pull of the land, mm. as a lot of expatriates do, I think. Mm. And he really wanted to come home to New Zealand. And so he moved to Auckland first. And then when he tried to make that his little Wagner paradise and that didn't work, we then moved to Brisbane.
Yeah.
And that's, I suppose I feel myself more Australian than anything else because mm. I did all my high school there, university there. Mm. And that's where I really learned to play the piano.
And,
really
and you studied at the music. Queensland Conservatory.
Yeah. With yeah. two extraordinary Russian teachers.
Yeah. Well, that must have been, I was about to say peculiar, but odd when you're in Brisbane with this incredible climate and then going into work with these Russian pianists who come from a completely different culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they soon adapted to this culture, I believe. But, but to start with, there was a kind of a rigorous discipline that
yeah.
we all had to go through. And it was a sort of magnificent wake-up call for everybody mm. there. And we suddenly practiced mm. like crazy. Mm. And some people were quite badly injured doing that because, you know, when you've been doing nothing much except going to the beach and
yeah.
having a great time and then suddenly you practice 6 hours a day minimum,
yeah.
buggers up your hands.
Yeah. But you had a lot of success as a pianist too.
Yeah, look, I really wanted to be a pianist. Mm. I didn't in particular want to be involved with anything else except the piano, even though my dad was a conductor. I had a yen for the great symphonic music, as everybody does. But it was in about the fourth year of the conservatorium that I found Wagner.
Mm.
And that was pretty much the end of my piano career because, you know, you're going through the con and there's always this strange separation of musicians and singers at the con.
Mm.
And so, you know, the great repertoire is the piano repertoire, it's the chamber music, it's the symphonies, it's mm. the choral pieces, that kind of stuff. It's definitely not opera.
Yeah.
And so you learn about the canon of music through playing this stuff, listening to this stuff. But then there's kind of a gap. Mm. You know, it's like, how do we get from Brahms to Schoenberg, Debussy? How did this happen? And the answer, of course, and you can't believe it at the time, mm. is Wagner,
yeah.
an opera composer.
Mm.
So I got completely addicted to Tristan in mm. particular and just listened to it over and over again, not having a clue what the words were, not interested, just mm. sit in the library and look at the full score and just listen to this music that I didn't know could mm. possibly, I didn't know music like that could exist.
Mm.
And of course, neither did anybody else.
Yeah.
And it sort of, everything goes to and develops from or against. And, you know, when you have that sort of a feeling for something, other things start to pale into insignificance mm. somewhat.
Mm.
And I remember distinctly when I moved to Germany to study, we have a limited amount of time. You know, you book your room, it's a very nice room and everything. And you have, say, 2 hours to study. Mm. And I would take down a Wagner score. Mm. And I would play Götterdämmerung or something for about an hour and a half. And I think, oh my God, I've got to learn my Mozart sonata or Beethoven sonata. And the comparison at the time seemed quite tawdry. Mm. You know, for a while, when you're first encountering Wagner, nothing else matters except Bach. Bach can do it. Everything else seems rather tawdry in comparison. So it was just really difficult. And that's when I thought, well, I've got to get into this. Mm. And then this terrible thing happens where you actually like singing. Then it all develops from there.
And you came to Opera Australia.
I did.
And as a repetiteur?
I did, yeah.
And how were those first few years?
Oh, look, they were incredible. But because, look, I came straight out of university, decided that I didn't want to be a pianist, I wanted to get into opera. Mm. And I did two auditions, one for Covent Garden, and I don't think I've ever been more nervous. And then the second one, about 2 weeks later, was for Richard Hickox. Mm. And of course, I played much better the second time, because I knew what to expect and all that kind of stuff. And he said, why don't you come here? I said, all right. And then you just find that you just fight to stay afloat.
Yes.
For the first 4 or 5 years, it's like, oh, I have to play another score.
Yeah.
Okay, and then, do you mind just jumping in and playing, you know, a little bit of Bohème? I remember one terrible time when I thought I was going to play, on the call sheet, it said an excerpt of the third act of Bohème. Beautiful to play, you know, quite slow, luscious, fantastic, but everybody knows Bohème so well. So I came in, this was the first time I'd played it, and they said, actually, we're doing a run of Bohème. Oh my God, I hadn't even looked at the fourth act. You know, so he's just, you're sitting there and just thinking, oh my God, it's all going to fall apart from me. And somehow you just make it through by the skin of your teeth.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of experience that's so important to have.
Yeah, well, with repetiteurs too, and particularly in the beginning, the reason I ask the question is that you're learning so many operas in a very, very short space of time. And of course, not only the coaching them with singers, but you're playing the piano rehearsals in the theatre. And they can be, you know, tense, difficult, and often traumatic. And so you do need to have not only a fantastic technique, but also a temperament to be able to do that. And it's a great training ground for the people who are successful to have to go through that.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything you said is right on the money. It's a really difficult job.
Yeah.
At times it can be very, very stressful. You never feel like you're prepared.
Yeah.
I think now, if someone asked me to come in and play Bohème, I go, yeah, great,
yeah,
terrific.
Yeah.
But you just never feel like you're really on top of things. You're always turning the page sort of hoping that you've looked at it before, and sometimes you just haven't had the chance.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And you make judicious decisions as you're looking through, you know, a score of The Ring or something. You kind of go, right, better practice that bit. Oh, I reckon I can sight read that bit. So you don't look at that bit. And then, of course, you get to that bit in the production or whatever, and generally falls apart a little bit. Because you're sight reading, but you're sight reading at the same time as trying to listen to singers, watch the conductors, interpret what the conductor's doing, listening for other things going on, and then, you know, a director will sometimes call out stop, and sometimes they will just call out something you think they've said stop, and then you stop the entire. It's fun though.
Absolutely, but then you became head of music. When Tony Legg went back to England.
Great Tony Legg.
Yeah, Tony's wonderful. And that was a lot of responsibility because, you know, you're still very young. And coupled with that, we then started asking you to conduct operas. So it was a double sense of responsibility in pretty close succession.
Yeah, I mean, that was thrilling. And I mean, it's always what I wanted to do, to conduct. But the added responsibility it weighs a bit, but it's, of course, exciting and thrilling. So now I don't play on any particular show, but I sort of have to be across them all, and if necessary, jump in and play whatever, or conduct a rehearsal, or, God forbid, you know, sing a part in from the side or something, much to everybody else's chagrin, but, you know. And I'd conducted a couple of shows whilst I was still a repetiteur.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what you do is you take the whole rehearsal period through and you learn it back to front and you coach it with the singers, you play production rehearsals, you go to all the performances, and then you just jump straight into the pit. And that's quite frightening. But when you're the head of music, you don't generally go to all, excuse me, those rehearsals.
Yeah.
So you have to, I quickly had to learn things in a different way and find a different way of learning them that wasn't always through my fingers. Basically, you learn everything through your fingers.
Yeah.
You know, you just play it and play it and play it, and then suddenly you realise, oh my God, it's pretty much know it from memory.
Yeah.
But you just don't have the time to do that, and you're looking out for other things, and so you had to, you know, basically stay up very late to learn things.
But it's you referred to learning a piece and playing through all the rehearsals. But a lot of what you do now is you jump in and take over. You know, we have a conductor who may be conducting Bohème for a number of performances, and then you go in virtually with no rehearsal to conduct it. And obviously that's, well, for a company like Opera Australia, it's vitally important to have someone like that, and particularly if they're the head of music, to be able to do that. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you prepare for something like that?
Well, again, those things you never feel like you're properly prepared, I think, just because the situation is pretty demanding, you know. And so what in particular I do is I make sure I go and see several performances of the previous conductor, minimum three, I would say. So you really start to know what he or she is doing. And that a piece like Bohème, for instance, has got all these incredibly tricky chords. Push,
tricky.
Pull, listen, everything. And you might want to do something slightly different. And the orchestra is superb. They will do anything you want. And the singers are, generally speaking, wonderful like that as well. So you prepare by learning the score basically from memory. And there's a lot of what Bertrand Russell used to call fruitful monotony, which is something that we don't want to talk about now. But you know, I don't have a photographic memory, so I just got to sit there and I've just got to learn it. And sometimes that just involves rote learning, repetition. And that's a great thing to do. You just do it over and over and over, and hope that practice makes perfect, not permanent, because sometimes you can practice the wrong thing in. But you do that constantly. You find every way to look at the score, you know, so that hopefully nothing will surprise you when you get in there. You try and actually look through every single part, what they're doing, how they relate to the other parts, what you think you're going to do, what the other conductor has been doing, what the singers do, and then you sort of think, I think the singers actually might want a fraction more time here that the conductor, for whatever reason, probably because he has a you know, a wonderful musical vision, doesn't want to do in particular. And you sort of think, can I do that? Do I want to do that?
And how do you do that with an orchestra?
Ah, I'm going to start talking about conducting.
Yes, exactly. well, communicating what you want to do musically to, you know, 60, 70 players who've played it a million times before and probably all have their own ideas about how they think it should go.
No question. And that's the, I suppose, one of the most frightening things, that you think, probably the orchestra knows it better than me, but still I've got to be in charge.
Yeah.
And you have to be. I mean, I think it's now more of a benevolent dictatorship rather than the Fritz Reiner sort of, oh, you played a wrong note, you're fired.
Yeah.
That certainly doesn't happen, but you've got to be in charge, and particularly when, you know, something's happening on the stage and then there's an offstage band and then some, you're the person who can probably hear it best. So you've got to work out how your gestures will translate into something that, that the orchestra can do. And clarity is a very difficult thing to find. Actually, you think it's very easy, and you know, there's that famous story of a student going to one of these great Russian professors, Musin or something, says, "Maestro, maestro, how do you conduct?" He said, "Well, two, you go like this, one, two, three, you go like this, one, two, three, four like this, one's like this." The student goes, "Oh yeah, I can do that." He goes, "Yeah, good." He goes, "Oh, it's not very difficult." I said, "Yeah, shh, but don't tell anybody." And that's kind of true at a certain level, but then you've got Richard Strauss who says, you know, as I get older, I find it more and more difficult. It just becomes the most incredibly difficult thing to do. But also I think orchestras have changed a little bit. So orchestras are fantastic. Like this orchestra, you know, when I conducted Carmen a couple of months ago, I took great pleasure in starting the overture and then just basically not conducting at all. They know it.
Yeah,
I find it almost insulting to go one, two, one, two, one, two, you know, and show them something else and they can do it without you.
Yeah.
So they're ready to be shown something.
Yeah.
And so you work out how your gestures will change the tempo, change the mood, change the dynamic. And it's this wonderful thing where you're dealing with a live sound. So again, it's a little bit, I think once upon a time conducting was very much, you know, metronomic. One, two, three, you know, just bang, bang. And nowadays, half the time, you're sort of listening to the sound and then shaping it. I can't remember who said it was called, it's like shaping the invisible. You know, it's this beautiful thing. And then, you know, in our library, we've got these videos of conductors and the conductor cam. And I mean, you have to look at them before you take over a show as well.
Yeah.
It's really important. Beating patterns and God knows what. But sometimes it's really interesting, if you turn off the sound, one conductor will look very unclear. All sort of wishy-washy nonsense, you know. And another conductor looks, oh, it's fantastic, you know, I can know exactly where he is. But then when the sound is there, it's like that guy who's listening and then it makes perfect sense. And the other one's like, that's not actually what the sound is. The sound isn't that, you know, it's that sort of perhaps a warm sound or a big sound or a flowing sound or something. And the orchestra will respond to all of that.
Yeah. As you say, the Opera Australia Orchestra is an incredibly flexible orchestra.
Amazing.
They play at a very high level. But it's up to the conductor to actually shape the performance. You know, whether to go quicker here, is it dragging? Does the drama fall out there if I go at this tempo? So even though you're modestly saying that, you know, you don't have to do that much, it's up to you to make it a performance. And I guess that's the difficult thing.
Oh, no question. And I mean, both Boheme and Carmen, you know, I wanted to do some different things. And it is slightly heart and mouth stuff when you think, you know, they've done maybe 10 performances and then you do something quite different sometimes, sometimes even a slightly different beating pattern, and you just hope that it's really clear. You've had perhaps a rehearsal with the singers, perhaps two. Might be it, and you just try. You know, you're pretty sure it's going to work, but just heart and mouth sometimes. Is this going to work? It's so different from what the previous thing was.
Well, looking forward to the end of this year, we're doing one of your favorites, we're doing The Ring.
Yep.
And you're the assistant conductor with Tony Legg, which must be a lot of fun, but it's also 16 hours of music. So how do you approach? I mean, I know you've had a lot of history of Tristan and learning pieces and so on, but nevertheless, it's 16 hours of music, some of the most sublime music ever created. What's your starting point from the beginning of Rheingold to the end of Götterdämmerung?
Well, it's funny. I remember the first time we did The Ring, and I hadn't done it before. I remember thinking, okay, and I was actually on all four operas. And I remember sitting in the main rehearsal room in Melbourne at about 9 o'clock at night, all four scores there, and I thought, if I just play it through now, not practicing, just play it through, I'm going to be here until 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. So what do you do? And so you do that judicious thing where you go through it and you choose passages. This is difficult, this is impossible. Sometimes you think, right, I'm just not going to be able to play that in the time I've got. It's like a piano concerto, you know, so find some way to do it. You know, Tony Legg used to say, don't play the rubbish, you know, which is an amazing sort of thing for someone to say. And so you try and work your way through it gently, and you do have to leave some of it pretty much to chance, because I just have not time to practice, had time to practice those couple of pages.
And I imagine too, some of the most sublime music in it, you spend more time working on that because it's so fabulous to play.
Yeah, you some Wagner really does sound wonderful on the piano.
Yeah.
And so you do get sucked in, and you know, there are some bits of Siegfried which are just diabolically difficult to play on the piano and sound pretty much terrible. So you find, you know, you play great swathes of Götterdämmerung where you can actually almost sound like an orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's when you have to force yourself to do that fruitful monotony.
Yes.
This is going to be hard work.
Yeah.
But just force yourself to do it.
Yeah. So it's, as I said, it'll be a wonderful experience because, and we're still planning to do the ring in November, December this year in Brisbane. And then when the orchestra comes, and as I said, this is the first time you've been the assistant conductor on the ring, that'll be a wonderful experience.
Mm.
And you'll be conducting a number of the rehearsals as well with Tony in different rooms.
Yep.
So that will be a tremendous amount of fun too, I'm sure.
That'll be amazing. I can't wait.
We've got wonderful cast. So it'll be an exciting time. But today, I'm not going to ask you to sing, even though I know you have sung in your past. But we'll return to your first love, the piano. So would you like to tell us what you're going to play today?
I'm going to play the last prelude in the first set of preludes, the Opus 23 of Rachmaninoff, which I used to play quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that set of preludes, coupled with a set of studies by New Zealand composer Edwin Carr, was the first proper recital I gave.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually finished with this prelude that I'm about to play for you now.
Wonderful. We looked forward to it, Tahu.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my guest.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for listening to In Conversation with Lyndon Terracini. We hope you've enjoyed the chat, and we'd love for you to subscribe to the podcast. That way, you'll get each new episode as they're released. We also hope to see you in the theatre in the not-too-distant future. And you can stay up to date with all we've got going on at opera.org.au.